Hello and welcome to Coach and the Doctor. I'm the coach, not a real coach, and with me is Doctor, not a real doctor. Welcome, Doctor.
Coach, good to be here.
Do you notice I was a little bit more laid back?
You are very laid back.
Yeah.
Well, why is that?
Oh, I just thought, you know, I've been a bit over the top lately.
And for the last 25 years, yeah.
25, I'd say probably 50 or 60 years, and I just thought I'll try a new coach. See what happens. See if anybody...
Because the old coach has been very successful for you.
Exactly. NDIS. Now, I know you've got a story.
I know. I'm excited today.
Because we've decided we're going to record these pieces when something happens, and it usually happens every day. So as soon as something happens today, Doctor, in the studio, let's talk about it.
Yeah, no. Where do I start?
Well, first of all, let's be honest. We actually started to record this about 3 or 4 days ago, and I forgot. We got about 10 minutes in, and I forgot to hit the record button.
But we didn't have this news then.
No, we didn't.
So here's a story. J-Man, as you know, Coach, does free advocacy. Help people get on the NDIS from start to finish because it's a bit of a process.
Yeah,
it's a process. It's a minefield, and nobody really understands it. Had a gentleman reach out 2 months ago. The most beautiful person you would ever meet has a intellectual disability, moderate to severe, I would say, but just one of those people that when you meet them, they just put a smile on your face. Anyway, he reached out through Bowls Victoria and J-Man's sponsorship of Bowls Victoria and wanted to get on the NDIS. No problem. We'll help you. One little problem.
Wow.
He was 64.
Which, for the for people who don't know, 65 is the cut-off date.
65 is the cut-off date.
So for the NDIS.
It is. And not only was he 64, he was 64... and 10 and a half months.
No.
So...
Uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-oh.
And there's no exceptions either. Has anybody tested this rule yet or not? Maybe they have at some stage. I don't know. I haven't seen any precedent for it.
No, neither have I. And so we knew we had to get our skates on.
Yep.
So we started the process, and about a week into the process, his father passed away.
Oh, no.
So he was left at home by himself, does have family... Very supportive, but lives by himself. And, of course, mourning, death of his father, funeral, all that kind of stuff. So weeks were lost.
Which are vital at that stage.
At that point, because normally you go, well, you know, we'll just put it back 28 days or 30 days. But we didn't have any time to waste. So we had to get the access request form in and approved before he was 65. So we put the access request form in with everything that was needed. The NDIS came back and said they needed more information.
Because they wouldn't be an issue for them, his age.
No.
It's just black and white for them, isn't it?
And look, and to their credit, they said, it's okay, even you can get the information to us after he turns 65. That's okay, so because he's in the system now.
Yep.
However, if he gets knocked back, you can't reapply. Now, as you know, often when we're doing advocacy, we have participants knock back 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Mm. And it's usually just based on lack of evidence or evidence that they require. And it's just a process that we go through and we say, yep, no worries. Now, if that had happened with him, there was no recall because he wouldn't have been able to put in a new application because he was over 65.
I remember you came into the office and said to me, oh, we've got to get this right.
Yeah,
otherwise he's in trouble.
If we get one crack at it.
So then I hope there is a good ending to this story. I know you're happy, so there's got to be some sort of...
Yeah, it is a great story because we got a phone call today from the NDIS.
Yeah?
Been approved.
Fantastic.
He's over the moon, and we are too. The office staff, Sarah, who did a great job in getting him over the line and getting everything together and going to his doctor's appointment, speaking with his doctor, and it's... He's... Oh, look, he's rung me already, told me to ring his sister, which I've done, and he's saying, so when can I start, when can I start? And I said, well, now there's a process we need to go through. There's got to be a planning meeting and all of that. But it's just so exciting and rewarding because if he hadn't got on, he's only 65, you know, he's active and he's in good shape, but if he hadn't got on the NDIS, I don't know what would have happened.
Well, it probably would have shortened his lifespan by the sound of it. I mean, I'm probably sounding melodramatic here, but that's usually what happens because I know, and we've had this discussion, I know that Bill Shorten mentioned not that long ago, of course he's the Minister for the NDIS and the one that helped create the NDIS, He said that he's going to take a solid look at that age limit of 65. Now, whether or not he does, whether or not anything comes of it, I don't know. But I think that's a really good idea because that is still, in this day and age, 65, very young. Yeah, there's a lot of very sprightly 65s running. Unbelievable.
Any that you would know?
Oh, there's a couple here and there. He's having a birthday pretty soon, but yeah.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely. But for his situation and the pressure that it would have put on his family as well, because he does have a loving family around him, but they've all got their own lives. And they've got their own lives, their own kids, their own families. And he's sitting there at home by himself and wants to get involved in lots of different activities, wants to get out in the community, but just needs somebody to kind of hold his hand, for want of a better term, and take him out. And he's going to benefit immensely from it. You know, I kept saying to the staff here at J-Man, we just can't let him down.
And this is the thing every day, is that if you don't make that phone call, or you don't speak properly to potential participants, or you don't take an interest, it affects their lives. And that's so important. And it, you know what? In the end, it affects our lives because look how happy you are.
Oh, mate, I'm super chuffed. I don't even know the words. I've got to spring him a step because that's why we're here, to help these people. And talking to his sister, not only was he happy, but talking to his sister because, I mean, he could have been on the NDIS and probably should have been on the NDIS for the last 6 or 7 years since its inception. But nobody knew anything about it. He didn't know anything about it. His family didn't know anything about it. To help them is just so rewarding, and I'm real excited to introduce him to all our support workers and to support coordinators and to other participants and
get him on Coaching the Doctor.
Mate, he would be great. He would be great, and he loves his lawn bowls. He played in the feeder competition as well. Plays indoor cricket as well. There's an all abilities indoor cricket competition, and he just wants to do it all. But then at a very basic level too, he needs help with budgeting, cooking meals, keeping his house clean, a little bit of personal care as well. And yeah, so he's gonna benefit immensely.
Well,
from
I'm looking forward to meeting him. Now coming up, it's usually your cue, Doctor, but you're a bit slow on the old uptake there.
Oh, I'm still excited.
You're
mate,
still
isn't
excited, it? Yeah. Coming up next, a couple of great guests. Seamus Evans, Ambassador for Tourette Syndrome Association Australia and a keynote speaker and a funny guy.
Yeah, great guy.
When I was editing this, I just laughed all the way through it.
And that was funny?
Yeah, well, you try to be funny. You're funny because you think you're funny. That's funny in itself. And then, but first up after the break, Nicole Matheson. She's team leader and clinical neuropsychologist at Autism Spectrum Australia. And it really opened my eyes, this discussion about autism and why they do things and why they label things and why they don't label things. But that's happening after the break here on Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators Julie Care, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching.
When your message is timely, trustworthy and delivered in a positive environment, it's powerful. That's why sponsors of 89.9 The Light see great results. Visit thelight.com.au.
Ever thought of changing your lifestyle or maybe even your career? But you're a bit nervous about taking the plunge into the unknown. Well, now is the time to get your feet wet. J-Man is an NDIS registered support provider that is now hiring. As the world is adapting to change, it's your time now to not only make a difference, but to also earn the sort of living you deserve. Call 1-800-JAE-MAN or visit our website, jman.com.au.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
You're listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators, where it takes a village. With me is Dr. Not A Real Doctor, Coach Not A Real Coach.
Coach, how are you today?
I'm fantastic. Doctor. I'm looking forward to speaking with this next person. Nicole Matheson is her name, and off air, you actually gave her an intro without actually giving her an intro. So normally I would give the intro, but why don't you go for it, Doctor?
Well, no. I will give it a go. We have got a very special guest today.
Who is that special guest?
That special guest is Nicole Matheson, who is a team leader and clinical neuropsychologist at Autism Spectrum Australia, otherwise known as ASPECT.
So well done, Doctor. Yes, well done. He got it right. That was fantastic. Hi, Nicole. How are you?
Good. Lovely to meet you both.
Thank you for joining us on Coach and the Doctor. First question. A Master of Clinical Neuropsychology and a Master of Research at Macquarie University. How long does that take? How did you get involved?
Oh, a while, I guess, is the short answer for things for that. So basically, throughout the couple of masters, I did them currently. So did them at the same time and overall just took it was about 3.5 years to get through the two different master's programs. So however, in going into those, that was after already a period of 4 years and a degree in neuroscience and psychology and an honours in psychology before moving into the master's programs at that point. And how did I get into it, I think, is a very loaded and big question. And there's kind of a lot of different things that led me into this field. But I think that real kind of interest in the brain and that connection between the brain and behaviour led me to finding out more about neuropsychology and really honing down on that and developing a passion there.
I've got an answer for you. She's just a brainiac.
She's a brainiac.
Because I've got an interest in all that as well, but there's no way that I could do it.
And the thing is, you look young, and I'm not going to comment on your age, and a lot of the people that we do speak to are very young. But then just having said that, Nicole, I realise everybody's young compared to me and the doctor.
That is true.
So
that is
really
true. And getting younger.
And yes, and getting younger.
Can I ask a question?
Doctor, ask a question.
Nicole's research master's evaluated the social cognitive skills of the genetic condition 22q11.2 deletion syndrome and its relation to schizophrenia and autism.
I tell you what, you needed all your cognitive ability just then to read that out.
What does that mean, Nicole? Remembering you're talking to the coach and the doctor, so very, very simple here.
So, Nicole, was that a good question? Was that a good question, you'd say?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a good question, thanks. So, okay, we'll give you one of those then, okay? You get a good question.
Well done. No, it's a fantastic question. I think you've got a lot to it. Fantastic. Even better with it. Basically, I guess 22q11.2 deletion syndrome is a relatively common genetic condition that not many people know of. And there's still a lot of research to be done in it. And what I was doing was having a little look at that connection of the idea of beyond just what we knew about more of the physical features and the medical condition as part of 22q11.2, otherwise also known as VCFS or velocardiofacial syndrome.
For the uneducated.
You must have an easier nickname that your colleagues use. You must, surely.
We did just call it 22Q a lot of the time, right. And there were 22 cuties, they called them, some of the people who fit in part of that, which I really enjoyed. But we knew that there were some differences in the way that they interacted with other people and sometimes had some difficulties understanding their social world, a lot of the people I was interacting with. So we wanted to see how that had similarities or how that differed to people who had previously or been diagnosed with autism or schizophrenia, both of which have also been known to have some differences in the way people understand and interact with others.
So 22Q is different to autism or schizophrenia. Is that what you're saying?
It absolutely is.
And what's the main difference?
So 22Q is a genetic condition. It is able to be tested for genetically, and there is so in terms of that it's not based on a symptom-based diagnosis. Both of schizophrenia and autism are different to that, and they are diagnoses based on clinicians being able to do it based on the behaviours and the interactions that we're seeing. 22Q is diagnosed genetically, and people can have both. So someone with 22Q can also have autism, but we were trying to find out a little bit further to that, is there some misdiagnosis there, because is there actually some crossover of the behaviours that occur in both of them. So as I said, there was some understanding that people with 22q might have some social differences. Were these the same as some of the social differences we notice in people with, say, autism or schizophrenia?
Could you explain what 22q is in terms of behaviours?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot to it. And I have to admit, I probably am not the top person on speaking about it at the moment. It has been a few years since I've worked directly with a lot of people in that field, but there are some wonderful people who work on research in 22q daily. But there's a few different patterns. So there's different patterns in terms of, say, physical patterns. There's a lot of higher instances of things like cleft palates or indications on someone's palate, so basically the top of their mouth. And there are some facial features that might distinguish someone as having 22q as well. In terms of, say, intellectual capabilities, many people who fit in this category tend to have some difficulties in some areas of what we consider part of that general intellectual profile and are often considered more within that borderline range. So don't quite meet that intellectual disability, but do have some concerns in terms of understanding others if it's not presented in certain ways or ways to help them. As I said, there's a few other things that we don't fully know and some of what I was trying to find out. And we were able to say that there were some social differences, understanding of some of those higher order social cognitions, things like understanding faux pas, if that's a word and many of your listeners may have heard of, or understanding that kind of social mistakes that are more based on the social rules, things that are unspoken. And understanding some of those more social context and cues, particularly things that are not directly stated but are just tending to be accepted that everyone should understand or know them.
So if you're at a party, do you diagnose people when you're there in your own mind?
That is a question I get a lot of the time. And I think a lot of psychologists in different fields would get that a lot. Look, there are certain things that might typically stand out to me, but no, I would have to say that's not the case. The diagnostic process takes a long time. And I work currently in the field mainly looking at diagnosing autism and associated conditions. And our assessments take of face-to-face time generally around 6 hours. It can be at minimum. And then additional time after that, getting further information and putting together other things. So speaking to someone at a party is generally not going to be able to give me enough information for a diagnosis, so I don't pretend to try and do that.
Well, surely you can say Donald Trump's a sociopath. I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
I mean, I won't say anything too much on that, but I know that there's been a lot of comments on the internet about narcissistic personality disorder for Donald Trump, and I can understand where they're coming from.
You nailed it.
He's not one to bring Donald Trump.
Well, he's one of my favourites. Donald Trump and Forbes. We haven't got Forbes into the conversation
yet.
I'm
sure we will.
Forbes, where are you originally from, Nicole?
I'm from Sydney. I live in Sydney now and still based here. I've moved away and done a few things in all over places in the world, and I've ended up 5 kilometres from where I grew up.
Which is?
Which is in the North Shore of Sydney.
Yeah, well, that's a big area. Come on, give us a suburb.
It's not one that many people would know about, to be honest, even up in Sydney. I do live, so I say nearby. I'm in a place called Crow's Nest.
Oh, I know Crow's Nest. I used to work at a radio station there, Today FM, Military many Road, years is ago.
Is anywhere near Forbes?
It's about 400 k's from Forbes.
Is that close enough?
Lovely part of the world. Very busy road there. The highway up there.
I'm very, very lucky with where I am. I absolutely love it here.
Nicole, autism seems to be kind of in fashion at the moment, for want of a better word. Everybody seems to be on the spectrum somewhere. Why is that?
It's an interesting question. It is one.
Would you say a good question?
I would say a good question, yeah.
Thank you. Coach?
I'm assuming there's going to be some applause there, if I can provide it myself if you like.
I didn't really want to do it, but anyway, go ahead.
It's interesting. I think it's something that comes up a lot of the time there. So there are quite a few different, I guess, reasons for why we say that there is an increase in terms of people diagnosed with autism or who associate or even self, you know, identify as being autistic. We know that even in terms of the research, it has shown that there are more diagnoses. I think a lot of it comes from our increased understanding of autism. So we have a better understanding of the spectrum of people that do fit on the autism spectrum, that large variety. We also have increase in terms of understanding autism in females in particular and in cultures and contexts that may not have necessarily been looked into as much before. So I think that's definitely what's impacting on that. Now, when we say people are you know, everyone is on the spectrum somewhat. I think there's a lot of debate around this and how to phrase it and put it together. I think most people will always show some kind of autistic traits, will have some parts of autism with which they identify. I can certainly tell you that there are definite parts of autism that I identify with myself, and some similarities in behaviours and interactions that I have with a lot of the clients I see. Where we differentiate, and I guess there is a little bit of a clear line there, is are we seeing that these differences impacting them to a significant extent? Are we seeing that we know that the world is not built for people with autism? The world is built around a way that is made for people who are considered neurotypical. And is this the fact that a person with autism is thinking a certain way and that world is built a different way? Is it impacting them on a daily basis and across many different contexts? And if it is, then that person would be considered as having autism. Whereas just having some traits, or just, you know, understanding that I don't like it when it's particularly loud, or I also, you know, don't necessarily like to, well, I think for me it's I use my hands way too much when I'm talking and use that for nonverbal, but that in itself isn't enough to say that I have autism or that someone has autism. So it's that, is it impacting them? And also, is it the overall pattern of behaviours that shows the way that someone's brain is working or is why it is functioning is a little bit different to a lot of their peers around them?
Well, the question is, are we living in their world or are they living in our world?
I think very much it's, I guess that's a question that might change over the years and a lot of things, but I definitely would say that the way that the world is built is not built typically for a person with autism or an autistic person. There is increased understanding and there are definitely changes that are happening in a positive direction for people with autism, but I still very much think that the world is built for those that are what we consider neurotypical, and that these changes are only really just the tip of the iceberg in helping people with autism.
I've just got one more question before we go to the break, Doctor. And after the break, of course, we'll talk about NDIS and connection with autism, also how the wider community can get more involved with people that are living with autism. But the question that I've got, why did it change to being on the spectrum? Why, you know, because all of a sudden Asperger's came under the autism spectrum. Why did that change? Was there any medical reason for that? Because it confused the hell out of me when it first happened.
Yeah, the movement from, there was previously, and it was as part of a psychologist, we work in Australia with a system called the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. It's what we use to make diagnoses and to classify people under these certain, I guess, labels that we would call them at this context. And it was actually a change in the DSM that moved. So it was a kind of, I guess, logistical change in that way. So we moved from the DSM-4, which had previous diagnoses that included things like Asperger's. There was another one called PDD-NOS, or Pervasive Developmental Disorder Not Otherwise Specified, and there was Autistic Disorder. When we moved on to the new version of the DSM, the DSM-5, in 2013, I think it was, we changed, and all of those fell under the umbrella term of autism spectrum. Now, this is a decision that was made from a large team of people worldwide, particularly in the US, but worldwide, making these decisions about what is best regarding the diagnoses. And there were a few different reasons for this change. One of the typical reasons I think that does come up a lot is that we often had misconceptions. So people would consider those with Asperger's, or what may have been previously termed high-functioning autism, which again is not something that's used anymore, to be people that had autistic traits but didn't have intellectual disability, whereas those that were autistic tended to also have that intellectual disability. Now, this is never what the diagnostic criteria said, but this was kind of the common understanding of it. Whereas, yeah, with the way that we have the change in it, we know that we're instead looking at the autistic characteristics. So we're looking at differences in social communication and social interaction, as well as some restricted and repetitive behaviours, and that's the diagnostic criteria across all of these. And then in addition to that, you can look and see whether someone also may have classification as having an intellectual disability or a language delay or anxiety, or these things that co-occur with it but are not in and of itself part of autism or part of the autism spectrum.
Well, doctor, not being a real doctor, you would have understood all of that.
Just after you finished the question, just after that, I kind of got lost.
You had me at DSM. Nicole, that was
fascinating.
Beautifully explained. Nicole Matheson's with us, team leader and clinical neuropsychologist at Autism Spectrum Australia. Got a stack more questions. We're going to talk to you about the NDIS after we have this quick break. Of course, this is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators, JewelderCare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching.
JewelderCare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, JilderCare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free.
It's not just radio, and it's not just Melbourne. Sponsors of 89.9 The Light benefit from a national footprint through our sister stations. Your business can be on air, online, and on mobile nationally through one point of contact. So to reach an exclusive audience around Australia, go to the sponsorship page at thelight.com.au and get in touch. Find out more about the unique opportunities we can offer your business. 89.9 The Light. Positive radio, positive reach, positive results.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Hey, Doctor, did you know J-Man Active has hit the ground running now that all the COVID restrictions, or most of them, have been lifted? They've got basketball, 10-pin bowling, lawn bowls, cricket, footy, and the list just goes on. Did you know that?
I did know that.
J-Man Active, great supporters of Coach and the Doctor. Not a real coach, not a real doctor. With us is Nicole Matheson. Doctor, you've got a question for Nicole?
Autism. Verbal versus non-verbal. Why?
Yeah. Well, interesting question. And I guess, again, it comes down a little bit to terminology there as well. And I know, I guess a term I hear a lot of that is more that minimally verbal as well in terms of it. But we look at those many ways in which people can communicate, that language is just one of the many ways in which people interact with others, in which they can communicate intent, interest, and all the different things that we engage with. Someone's language ability, again, is one of those things similar where I say is not actually part of the diagnostic criteria for autism. That's why we say that a person with autism can be both possibly the most verbose person you've ever spoken to, with more understanding of vocabulary than you or I. But a person with autism may also be someone who doesn't speak or who doesn't engage in any language use. So we look at it as something that the idea that someone has some language difficulties or someone has a delay in language, there is a much higher chance of having some difficulties with language when you have autism. But again, in and of itself, it isn't actually autism.
Right. So if you are nonverbal, I'll put it in my words, and you have autism, can you be taught to be verbal? Or does that obviously sits outside the autism?
No, there are things that come, because it is quite common within autism. I guess you can't, it's not a hard and fast answer for that. A lot of the time, people will not be able to, there might be people who never, ever are able to use speech in the way that you and I do use words and language that way, and may not ever be able to learn that way. What we look at is teaching communication. So that's the important part. It's about being able to communicate, both for an individual themselves with any of these diagnoses to communicate, but also to understand others' communication to them. So I think that's really where the focus is. It's on communication, not on language itself, because that isn't always something that can be taught to everyone.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because we've got this beautiful participant who is nonverbal, and when he gets a new support worker, his mother rolls out literally his dictionary, and it's page after page after page of his words and what they mean. And often it's just a grunt, or it's, you know, she's written it like it's, you know, brr means, you know, might be cold, you know, and so the support workers can communicate with him, because his parents can absolutely communicate with him, you know, and they'll tell him to stop being cranky or something, because they know his moods and they know his words. So the communication is quite fascinating. There's no question in that, but it's just a statement.
And we're lucky now, there's a whole lot of different options for increasing someone's ability to communicate and for helping in terms of communication between individuals. We look at some high-tech ones, a lot of iPads of things you've probably seen or heard of. Proloquo to go is one that comes up a lot. We also have picture exchange where participants might engage by, you know, showing pictures, having a chain around their neck of different pictures. But we also communicate just in terms of eye gaze or a facial expression as well. And all of these are really, really important in communicating and in developing relationships and in ensuring that people's needs and wants are being met.
Leading on to that, what are some common misconceptions about people with autism that you've come across?
Oh, yeah, that's a really, really...
good question.
It's a good question. It's a good question. You might say that a lot. I guess one of the major misconceptions that I like to bring up and that I find really interesting is that there is still this strong misconception that people with autism don't have empathy or don't care about others, which is absolutely incorrect, and it's not a part of autism of itself. The way in which a person might interact with others or the way in which they may show their care might be different to what their peers, different to how their peers do it, but there are huge amounts of empathy in people with autism and in autistic individuals. And I find there's a reason I work with this population, because I absolutely love working with the autistic community. I think I have met the most caring, considerate, kind people in engaging in this role. And I think that misconception is what bothers me the most when it comes to autism. I think in conjunction with that, we see a lot of misconceptions with the idea that people with autism don't want friendships or don't want relationships. And again, that is a really common misconception that might come up. There are some people that are very happy, some individuals or autistic individuals who are very happy with having one or two friends, and that's fantastic. And there are others who want to develop more friendships, want to have relationships, but that is a whole other spectrum itself. And having autism definitely doesn't mean that someone doesn't want to develop those relationships with others.
Well, that was actually Amy's question, our producer, who's sitting in the background there. I can see her up on the screen trying to stay awake, I think, Amy, because Amy's not feeling very well. She's a bit under the weather today, so she couldn't come into the office. But credit where credit's due, Amy. Well done. Good question. Thank you very much.
So what you're saying, Nicole, is that just like everybody else, some people like to have a whole bunch of friends. Other people just kind of want to stay in their own little cocoon and are quite happy. And some people show empathy more than others. And we've all got kind of different traits.
Absolutely. It's just the different ways that which someone might show these things. But it's absolutely that. All these are different. And we look at the idea of a person with autism understanding the world a little bit differently. A person with autism still experiences all of the same emotions, still has all of generally the same needs and wants, but they just experience and understand the world a little bit differently, think about it a little bit differently, which I think can often be a fantastic strength that is overlooked as well.
On a personal level, do you have anybody close to you that has autism?
I know quite a few people that do have autism and have associated conditions as well. To be honest, I think there's not really a person you're going to meet now who doesn't at least know a couple of people who have autism. We look at autism being, I think the current statistics in Australia is looking at 1 in 70 people. So wow. It is high in that context. And I definitely had, from when I was young, had met people and had people in my life that had that diagnosis. And then I have a lot of other people that I know that might have other criteria or might meet some of those criteria or have other diagnoses there as well. And I think I probably go out of my way to try and meet as many people with different points of view, because that's one of my favourite things to do, is from here, from people with different points of view. And it's something I've always done from when I was really young. So I've gone out and tried to make friends and engage in different ways with people.
In your role now, your role is now to diagnose people with autism, is that right?
Yeah, so that's a large part of my role now. So I'm part of the assessment team at Aspect, and a lot of what we do is making diagnoses of autism or associated or co-occurring conditions, or we get some help by someone who may have already been diagnosed, we might provide them with information on supports and where the impact their behaviours are having at the time and the impact that the supports that we would make suggestions for. We look for differences there. I engage and see how someone, if they have communication skills, engage in conversation or non-verbal communication, eye contact, gestures, body language. I ask the individual if they're old enough to speak or have communication abilities around their own experiences, and put them through a few little tasks using a standardised assessment that we call the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And we engage with that to take some notes and just get some understanding of the individual themselves. Typically then we also have some information for children. It's typically from their carer or parent or caregiver, sorry. And we have a very long interview that we do with them that, again, is a standardised interview called the Autism Diagnostic Interview Revised. And it goes for a couple of hours often to get through that interview. So it's a long period. And then in addition to that, we compare all of this and look against our diagnostic criteria. We might engage with teachers, with other professionals that might be working with the individuals, speech pathologists, occupational therapists. We may have information from someone from when they were younger through school reports or any previous reports that have been done, cognitive assessments, speech assessments. And we put all of that together and we will then understand and see how they do or how they might not meet that criteria for autism, and make a decision based on that and explain that across to the person and let them know what that means for them.
Wow, that's quite a process. Mm. So you've done all of that at ASPECT, and their ASPECT are a registered NDIS provider.
Yeah, yes.
What do you do with that information? Is there a department then you go, hey, here's somebody else that needs help, yeah, we need to get them on the NDIS, or do they just kind of, I don't know, go into the
network? Yeah, absolutely. Typically our reports we put together are ones that are able to be go-to. So we'll put a long report. Often they are quite long when they put it together, and these go towards the NDIS to be able to make an application. And they have all the things. So we help them on their way for that, to make the application to get on the NDIS as part of the process. So let them know where they can find that. And a lot of the report can just be something that's attached to it, so that it doesn't need all these additional bits and pieces. That report has all the information in it, which is great.
So you're talking about the access request form, that initial form that goes in,
so
this report goes with it?
Yeah, kind of. As part of the access request form, there's two parts to it. So you've got the individual part that's regarded done by the individual or the family, mm-hmm, and then there's a second part by the treating professional. So typically, if you actually have a little look at it, it does say that you can either complete this second part of it or you can attach a report. Yeah. That has all of this information. So our report can be used in that context. Right. If there's any concerns with that, we help with by completing the treating professional section. But typically they prefer just to have that report because everything's already in it and all the boxes are ticked there. So they just have to have their first part do that, and then they add this report to it, and that should hopefully help them engage. We usually have a chat on the day of the assessment if we're giving feedback and if we are suggesting that NDIS might be a good option for them. We have a bit of a chat to them about what that means and applying for that process.
So what's your experience of the NDIS?
Loaded question.
It's a loaded question, I think.
A good one, though. A good loaded question, and a good loaded interesting question, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Look, the basis of the NDIS is fantastic. The idea of choice and control for the individual is a really, really, really amazing thing to have, and I think it's really wonderful. I think there are a lot of times when people can get a bit lost in the system, where people might miss out on opportunities because they might not be aware of them, or we might find people who are from non-English speaking backgrounds, or people who they themselves might have some cognitive difficulties, or are from a low socioeconomic area and don't have the same access to some of the different supports. And I think all of these things are quite impacted, and I've seen some difficulties come across there in terms of being able to access NDIS and access the right amount of supports through NDIS. So I think there are still some kinks to be worked out due to that.
That is a good answer to a very ordinary question.
I think that I've interviewed...
I think Nicole's nailed it.
Well, I think she has, you know, and I think she's wasting her time doing what she's doing. She's definitely a politician with it, that sort of answer. I mean, I got nothing from that. She just talked and talked and talked around the issue.
No, no, she nailed it, mate. She's that's exactly how I would like to say it, but I can never
I'm only joking. No, it was a fantastic answer. But here's another Amy question, which I think is a great question, Amy. What do you think needs to be done in the wider community to better the lives of people with autism? Now, that's a loaded question.
It is, but it's an important one, as you're saying. It's really, and I think it's a question that everyone should think about and engage with. So what can be done? I think a lot can be done to better...
We've only got a couple of minutes, Nicole, so...
Wonderful. I think the starting point and the main part of it is actually understanding. So increasing our understanding of these differences, increasing our knowledge of what autism is and how a person with autism might be impacted by things that are going on around them and how... Yeah, so I guess that knowledge is the first side of it, because if we don't have that knowledge there, how are we then able to help people moving forward if we don't know what it is that's impacting someone or how to better that? So I think everyone should understand more about what autism is, some of the sensory differences, understanding in terms of routines, and understanding some of the ways in which people with autism prefer to communicate and engage with others. So researching on this is really important. I think that's a first step for most people in the wider community to help those with autism. I think also just being understanding of others. I think tolerating differences isn't enough. I think understanding differences is really where we need to go for that. And not being judgmental. Understanding that a lot of these things that people might do differently doesn't come from a place of rudeness, it comes often from a place of fear or comes from a place of misunderstanding. So I think being able to try and take someone else's perspective, which we often say people with autism have difficulty with, I think people without autism often can have difficulty taking the perspective of those with autism as well. So I think being able to try and walk in, you know, try and walk in someone else's shoes, walk in the shoes of someone with autism is something that we can all do and will hopefully improve the lives for a lot of those with autism.
No, that was a great answer. We should finish the show on that answer.
Yeah.
Did we get any better than that?
No. That's fantastic.
Nicole, before we go, is there any question you'd like to ask the doctor or myself?
No, I think that's kind of gone through most of the things, but I really appreciate you chatting to me today.
It's been fascinating, Nicole. We could keep chatting for hours, and I love Nicole's passion.
That's the thing that shines through with everyone we interview. You can't be doing this for any other reason other than you want to do this and you want to be here at this particular time in your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Congratulations.
No, I am very, very passionate about this I am very passionate about helping people with autism.
It's great.
We're trying to do our little bit, so we appreciate your time, Nicole Matheson. Thanks so much for joining us on Coach and the Doctor.
Thank you both very much.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
Hi, Coach here from J-Man. Back again with another season of the J-Pod, a podcast that is about living with and experiencing mental illness and physical disability.
Haven't had a relationship for 20 years since I broke up with my wife, because I don't feel like I would burden anybody with me because of my condition. It all gets back to that sense of being a lesser.
The J-Pod, brought to you by J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. jman.com.au.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators Gildacare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. Speaking of coaching, I'm Coach, not a real coach. Doctor, you're not a real doctor. We have to say that.
We do have to say that, because people assume I'm a doctor.
And they actually listen to your advice, which I'm not quite sure why they do.
Because I'm a doctor.
Because you are a doctor. With us Seamus Evans, who's Ambassador for Tourette Syndrome Association Australia, and he's a keynote speaker. So I'm told this guy, he's got a bit of charisma, he's a bit cool, he's not that good, bad-looking dude. So,
you're talking about me now or Seamus?
No, we're talking about Seamus, who I can't see. I can see Seamus up on the screen. There he is. Hey, Seamus, welcome to Coach and the Doctor.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. And the crowd goes wild.
Cheering crowd.
Oh, yeah, we've got some. Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
Right on cue. Okay, yeah. Gee, I'm quick, aren't I? I'm quick. Never know, I used to be in Brecky Radio myself.
That took like 30 seconds to come out.
Yeah, to talk about myself. I can tell you a good story about when I was radio at 2SM back in 1987, 88. That was a good story. You know who wrote for me for 3 or 4 weeks?
Who?
Doug Mulray's writer, Ken Sterling, wrote for me, comedy writer. They thought I was the next big thing. How wrong they were.
They were wrong.
1 month I lasted, Seamus, on 2SM Brecky Radio, but I had a couple of great romances, so that'll always stick with me in my memory.
And it wasn't a great story, by the way.
It wasn't a great story. No. Seamus is smiling. He's loving it. Okay. We could do this on Brecky Radio, why don't we do that? And we could get him on as a guest, even though we don't even know what he sounds like because we've been talking way too much. Mate, welcome to the show. Where do we start with Seamus? Do you have a question for him?
To talk about Tourette syndrome because I find it fascinating, as probably most people do. I don't know a lot about it, to be honest. When does it first rear its ugly head, for want of a better word? Like as a child, as a baby, or as a child? Like when were you diagnosed?
Great question. Yes, everybody.
Well, hang on, stay there.
Yeah. You get it. For every great question, you get one of those. I shouldn't have told you that. Now you're going to say that to him all the time. Okay.
Interesting, though, it's different for everyone. So typically, the medical journals typically say it's in childhood. I was born with it, or I got it from a very, very young age, like infancy, right? Really young, baby, diagnosed at 10. However, I know a guy who he got diagnosed and he only got it a year ago and he was 22. He was driving up from Melbourne. He moved to Queensland, said goodbye to his parents in his family home, and on the 2-day drive, he developed these tics. He thought, what the hell is going on? I've never had this before. They started getting really extreme. Coprolalia, which is the profanity, swearing tic. He's starting to flip the bird. He's like, oh my gosh, what is happening? Got diagnosed with Tourette syndrome. He's like, excuse me? So it's very different to individuals and it's specific to individuals. So the medical professionals have basically, they say it shows at around 10 years of age and will dissipate by the time you're 18, 21. I never like saying that. I never, because I meet so many young people with Tourette's and I will never say that it'll go because in my opinion, it gives a false sense of hope. I was told it'll be gone at 18. So 2 days before my 18th birthday, I'm like, yes, two more sleeps and I don't have Tourette's.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 31 and I still have tics all day, every day. So I don't like that statistic. Another one actually that I don't like is it's more common in males than females. And although it shows in males than rather than females, is because females are better at masking it. Same with autism and ADHD. The statistics all show more common in males than females. Whereas across the board, I would say that's fake. Not fake, but I would say that's not true. It's just that females are better at masking. So when they're tested, it doesn't show up.
It's really interesting that you say that somebody at 22 all of a sudden contracted Tourette's. What's the right wording?
So first of all, Tourette syndrome is a neurological condition made up of tics, both motor and vocal tics. You must have both motor and vocal to actually classify for Tourette syndrome. And I wouldn't say you contract it. I wouldn't say you develop it. You have it from the day you're born. And it is triggered. So it can lay dormant until something traumatic triggers it. So we have a theory that when I was a baby, I got an infection and went to hospital and, you know, was in hospital for a couple of days with a full body infection. As a baby, that's really traumatic.
Yeah, sure.
It could be as simple as being a baby and someone beeping a horn next to the baby. So it doesn't have to be extreme trauma. And then you know, for him to be driving away and leave his family home to start a new life at 21, that's quite a big thing. You know, it's I wouldn't say it's traumatic, but it's such a big thing to experience. It's nerve wracking,
stressful,
it's scary. Yeah. That would have been what triggered it.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of mourning your old life, which is which is what, another way of kind of looking at it. With the, and I'm not sure what it's called, but the profanities and all of that, why that? Does anybody know why that happens?
There are some theories. So Tourette syndrome, there's still a huge unknown around it. There are so many question marks and there's such a lack of evidence, a lack of research and a lack of data. So the profanity tic is actually called coprolalia, which in direct Latin translation, shit talk. Coprolalia, shit, lalia, talk.
Hey, this is a family show, mate. You can't be using that.
Well, that pretty much describes this show, coprolalia.
Yeah. That could be a new byline.
And then there are others, like copropraxia, which is the physical one, echolalia. There are so many different ones. But so my theory, and this is kind of, everyone has their different reasons and different theories and things like that. But after all the research I've done, because I don't have coprolalia, so the best way for me to understand it is by researching it, asking people questions and things. So you know the don't push the big red button?
Yep.
You want to push a big red button. Yeah. So if you're in a social situation and you know your brain says don't say that, your brain will say it if you have coprolalia. So I chatted to some young people who have coprolalia, and this one girl in particular, she said it comes out at a really inconvenient time when I see someone who's pregnant and my coprolalia tic says get an abortion. But I don't mean that. I really am so happy and want to give you congratulations. But my tick comes out and says, I'll get the coat hanger. And it's like, oh my gosh. But they don't mean that. That's not what they truly mean. But that's what it is. It's the don't push the big red button and it fires out.
Sounds like Kramer from Seinfeld.
Yeah.
He's a prime example of that. They must have written him around it, somebody with Tourette's. They must have. I always go back to Seinfeld at some stage, or where I'm from, Forbes in central New South Wales, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. Speaking about where I'm from, as a child, did it hold you back in your development?
Great question. Oh, there you go. Press the thing.
Oh, no.
Technically, Tourette syndrome, if you have Tourette's, you are a slow learner. But statistically, if you have Tourette's, you have a higher intelligence level than an average person. So at school, I was a definite slow learner. I failed school. Coupled with ADHD, mate, I graduated with no chance of doing anything afterwards. I failed school. In terms of holding me back, socially, yes. I was the weirdo. I was the odd one out. I was, oh, don't sit next to Seamus. He's weird. And there was a particular moment where I desperately wanted to be in the military, right? I said to Mum, Mum, I want to be in the army. I desperately wanted to be a police officer or an army guy. And one day Mum just said to me, says, they're not going to take you. You've got Tourette's. It's not going to happen. And I don't know if that's actually true or not, but at the age of 12, I just copped it as an answer. So in that regard, yes, it held me back. There was also a huge sense of insecurity. So like, there are many times where people, you know, if you're 10 or 12 and you don't feel like being different and you have tics that are so visual, you can't help but to stand out and people double take you and go, what is going on? And then they sense it might be a bit weird. So they ask the parent while you're in front of them, is he okay? What's going on? Why does your kid keep twitching like that? And so that sense, you know, it's everybody sitting around talking about me while I'm moving my head, doing that. So in that sense, it definitely created an insecurity. It created, oh, I'm different. I'm not like everyone else. But I had to learn how to accept it. I had to learn how to take it in my stride. I had to learn how to wear it with pride and, you know, proudly puff up the chest and say, yes, I am different. Yes, I have Tourette's. It doesn't define who I am. Doing that is a long journey, you know, lots of psychology and it's a hard road. It's a hard road. But in my opinion, you have two choices. You can sit in your bedroom and never leave because you don't want to face the world, or you can chin up, chest out and take it on. Stuff everyone, this is me.
Well, I'm going to make a statement. It doesn't necessarily define who you are, but it is who you are.
Yeah, it is definitely a part of me.
And as you said, you embrace it. This is what we find with a lot of participants that we've spoken to on the podcast, Coach and the Doctor, the same sort of answer that you've given. You embrace it, otherwise you stay in your room all day, every day.
Adversity is, you know, it either creates a hero or a victim. And I remember thinking that and I was like, you know what, I'm not going to let Tourette's hold me back. I'm not going to let these tics be a reason for me not to do something, and I will never let it limit my abilities of life.
Which is quite extraordinary, because reading your bio, at 18, you landed a job on a TV network, on Toaster TV. Now, that's a big call for any 18-year-old, let alone someone with Tourette's, who's, as you said, lots of psychiatry, lots of psychologists, lots of insecurities. That's quite remarkable that by the age of 18, you had made that decision. From that 12-year-old that got told by his mother that he's got Tourette's and the army won't take him, the police won't take him, that 12 to 18 is probably the toughest period for any person, let alone what you were going through, and somehow you've landed a job on TV. I love it.
Well, I had always wanted to be on TV. Once the police got taken and the army got taken, I was like, all right, well, what is it? And I have a natural ability to want to make people laugh, to want to entertain. You know, as a child, I'm doing the dance, or there's a family dinner with friends over, family friends, and I'm a little 7-year-old who runs out naked and goes la 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 and runs away because I like the reaction, right? That's what I want. And so I used to idolize Rove Live, idolized, you know, Graham Kennedy, idolized, you know, some of these big name television presenters and want to be them. I used to pretend I was on TV in my bedroom, you know, and that's what I wanted. In fact, I used to stay home and wag school in high school, and I would juggle and I would ride my unicycle and do handstands all day. And my dad he called me up and said, all right, Seamus, son, if you can juggle on a unicycle, we'll put you on television. And I was so stoked. But thinking back, I'm like, what the hell is dad going to do? Like, he's a car salesman. Like, who's he calling it at Channel 10? Listen, guys, I have got the content for you. Like,
he rides a unicycle.
Yeah. But what happened is, I don't believe in luck. It's preparation meets opportunity. And I was studying acting at the time, and I had an agent, and I got put forward for an audition, and I did very well in the audition. Now, up until this point, I was able to what they call suppress, which I, as the ambassador of Tourette Syndrome Association Australia, if you're listening, you've got Tourette's, do not suppress. It's very bad. But I suppressed when I was performing, right? During school theatre plays or whatever, I'd suppress and let them out. And I got the job, and they didn't know I had Tourette's, and I didn't tell them. So when I signed the contract, bang, contract signed. Then I started letting my tics out. And the boss was like, whoa, what's happening here? What's going on? Why does this kid keep twitching? And he said, hey, Seamus, what's going on? Why are you twitching like this? Because, you know, it was over a week of constant, you know. And he's like, what? This is not normal. And I told him, yeah, I've got Tourette syndrome. And he freaked out. Why are we afraid of the dark as kids? Because we don't know what's in it. And it was the same thing. He freaked out because he didn't know about Tourette's. And so he threatened to fire me. I was still under probation. And he said, well, listen, if you can't get in control of it, if it's going to be a problem, we'll fire you and get someone else. That is when I learned how to control them and how to manipulate them and redirect them, because my life, my job, I failed school. This is all I ever wanted. This was it. So that's when it really began, of learning how to go, hey, I'm not going to let Tourette stop me. I'm going to not let them control me. I'm going to control them. And that's when I learned how to redirect them.
Wow, because there's so many questions I want to ask you about Tourette's, and one specifically in the bio that Amy's given us, our producer, it was about how you control them and, as you said, suppress them. I want to ask you about how you did that and if you still do that after we take a quick break here on Coach and the Doctor. Beautiful segue. Being a former radio person yourself, you'll applaud that. But you're listening to Coach and the Doctor, and if you're looking to get the most out of your NDIS plan, without the stress, support coordinators, Gilda Care is the place to go. That is GILDA. Special guest Seamus Evans with us, back after this break.
Are you or someone you know in need of a compassionate support coordinator? Gilda Care is your team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. We'll make the NDIS process easy for you and your loved ones to navigate. We'll coordinate all your care and support, specialist support and, if required, psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gilda Care Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Visit us at gildacare.com.au.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives and promotes experiences for people with a disability. The NDIS can be confusing. So if you're thinking about applying for funding or not sure how your plan actually works, J-Man can help and guide you through every step of the process at no cost to you. jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au. Now is the time to get the most out of your NDIS. Call us for a free consultation. 1-800-JMAN.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. With us is Seamus Evans, Ambassador for Tourette Syndrome Association Australia and a keynote speaker. Doctor, before I throw over to you, because I know you've got a couple of questions you want to ask Seamus. Before the break, Seamus, you were talking about suppressing your Tourette's, and of course no one knew on the TV show that you had it. You disguised it with body language. Do you still do that now?
I need to separate these two things. So it's there's suppression and suppressing, and there's redirecting.
Right.
Very different.
Yep.
So in the Tourette's community, do not suppress. Suppressing is the same as not blinking. So if you don't blink, it's going to hurt your eyes. It's going to be fatiguing. It's going to be annoying. It's going to, and then you'll end up blinking anyway.
Mm.
So in our community, we say, listen, always let your tics out, always. Now, when it comes to redirecting, I didn't know this. I had no help. I had no therapy, nothing. I had to learn this myself. It's actually a therapy called CBIT, C-B-I-T, Cognitive Behavioral Intervention Therapy, specifically for tic redirection in Tourette's. I didn't know this at the time. This is only later I found this out. But what I had to, so to describe Tourette syndrome in a tic, it's like having an itch on your arm, okay? So you subconsciously will scratch that itch without even thinking. But I had to learn, hang on, my brain is telling me I need to scratch that itch. How can I scratch it and get that sensation without doing the movement of scratching it? And so I had to over, and this is what I say in my keynote, if I tick 200 times a day, every single time I tick, I do it slightly differently. So small movements daily compounding into significant results. So you do a tick 200 times, do it slightly differently. Over 3 months, it's a completely different tick. And you literally take it from a shoulder tick to a stomach roll. So today I have learned how to basically manipulate, control, and take over my tics instead of stopping them, because stopping them does not stop them. It just pauses them and they come out later. So it's a very long process and it is management. I call it management. You can stop and you can start, doesn't matter, it's management. So it's not a cure and they don't go away, but it's a constant ongoing management that you have to do. And I got to a point where I was on television for long periods of time and I was able to let my tics out by stomach rolls, stomach clenches, butt clenches, maybe biting my tongue or something to get that itch without it being so obvious.
So you can feel them coming on. Is that, I thought they were just kind of, would just happen and you had no control of them. Is it like you know you're about to sneeze? Would that be a...
Yep.
Where you kind of go, okay.
Short answer is yes, and then short answer is no. So when you're young, there is no controlling, there is no registering, there is no understanding it. I've had it for 31 years, right? Almost 32! I'm in a couple of days, I'm 32.
You're 14 years overdue, mate. What's going on?
Yeah. I've had it for a very long time. So I understand it. My experience with understanding a tick, I can register it. Not everybody can. It's up to that individual and their relationship with it and how long they've been on the journey of understanding it. Sometimes I'll tick without knowing still to this day. And sometimes I can stand there and register every single tick. So it really comes down to that individual and how much effort and neurological effort they want to go to actually registering them, understanding them. To sum it up, how it works really quickly, everybody's brain self-regulates to keep alive like an engine, like a piston in an engine. To keep alive, it self-regulates by firing off signals to the body. Everybody, these are unwanted signals. But everybody's brain has a gate to stop those unwanted signals. People with Tourette's have a weak or no gate, so those unwanted signals fire through. So from going from point A to point B, I am able to go, oh, I've got a tick coming. Here it is. And so, for example, one of my tics is that sound, right? But I spit, right? There's a lot of spit that comes out. So if I know I'm going to do it, I turn away from whoever I'm talking to and cover my mouth and go. So I can feel it. I know it. It's not like I spit in someone's face. I feel it and go, ah! carry on.
You should take some lessons from him, Coach.
Well, I notice that when I do sneeze, a lot of stuff comes out. But anyway,
how many ticks a day would you have?
Oh, I would say it's around that 200 mark.
200, so
it's very small, from excessive eye blinking to throat clearing to, yep. You know.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, when you said you're talking to somebody, how about the love life? Has it affected the love life, the relationships?
If it has, I haven't known about it because I don't get a call back. I have an amazing girlfriend at the moment. Well, hopefully forever.
just at the moment.
Yeah, just at the moment, mate. She'll be gone next week.
Seamus, if you get 10 years, mate, you should be happy, mate. That's about it.
However, in all of my partners, they've all said it's very endearing and it adds character and they like it. And if they don't like it, I don't know, because for whatever reason, yeah, they didn't call me back yep. or text me back. So whether it was my arrogance, my ego, or my Tourette's, I have no idea. But
I would say your looks personally, but anyway, that's just me.
In my experience, it hasn't stopped me, no.
That's the pot calling the kettle black. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
You can ask a question. It's probably not a great question, but it'll be a question.
It actually will be a great question. I was going to ask you about your stand-up. Are you still doing that? Number what?
You know what? I have had to pull back because I have too many speaking roles. And I was not funny. You know what? I love doing stand-up, okay, but I can't write a joke. So to the point where I would go up without material because my strength was improvising. My strength was crowd work. And every time I wrote a joke, they wouldn't go down very well at all. And even throughout my television and my radio career, if I ever planned what the inside terminology, for those of you listening, an out, right? So you'd plan to say something as you press the button and it is the end of the segment and you want a powerful, funny out. Every time I planned it, it was not funny. But it was when it came naturally, that's when it was funny. So I had to tap into, I had to go up on stage with no material, so nervous, so scared because I had nothing to fall back on. And I had to do this a few times and no one laughed. So I felt comfortable in silence. It's like being comfortable at ground zero, step one. So I'd go up there with nothing and no one would laugh. And I'd be able to catch my breath, regulate my heartbeat and think, okay, this is fine. It's not as bad. And that would like almost allow my brain to think naturally, if that makes sense.
Yep, yeah.
And I would just start conversations with the crowd and then bang. Then I'd get the best laughs when I was improvising.
That's exactly right, because that's what you're taught by the best when you are a disc jockey, is that it's the first thing that comes out of your mouth after a song comes on. So we'll get you to do your radio voice in a minute. But I know when I was like, 1272 SM with such and such my real name, it didn't matter what I said in the middle, pretty much. It was how I ended it. Yeah. It was how I ended it. That's what they remember going into the spots.
With the stand-up, did you use Tourette's as a topic? We've spoken to a couple of comedians with different conditions, bipolar and a few others, who kind of use their condition cerebral palsy as part of their routine. Is that what you
Absolutely. Did? Absolutely, yes. I've got a good 20 minutes, I would say, on pure Tourette's jokes. I made a very clear decision a long time ago that I won't be laughed at, I'll be laughed with. And in order to do that, I'll be the first one to make the joke. And because there's a big difference. Now, listen, when you have Tourette's, people are going to laugh for your whole life. Inherently, Tourette's syndrome cannot not be funny. Like, you're sitting in a room and this happened the other day. I was hanging out with a bunch of kids with Tourette's and a lady brought out a coffee and he just goes, penis. Like, they can't. That can't not be funny, right?
Yeah, gotta laugh when the word penis comes out.
Exactly. So the thing is, I remember thinking there's a difference between, you've got Tourette's and, that was a funny tick. So one of my ticks is I kind of nod my head back as if I'm saying g'day to a mate, right? The amount of times I walk down the street and I get people saying hello to me because it looks like I'm saying hi to them. Now, that inherently is hilarious. So I made a clear decision. I'm going to be the first one of the joke. I'm going to make the jokes. I'm going to be in control of how people laugh around me. And that's how I found my funny, if that makes sense, with Tourette's. So absolutely. I've got so many jokes on Tourette's that I really worked to the bone because I wanted to break that stigma and I didn't want to be embarrassed by it. And I found making the joke is going to relax everybody. So I found making the joke is disarming to the bullies, disarming to the negative attacks. It's disarming to the, haha, you've got Tourette's.
Would you say, with having experienced this for 31 years, what would you say to people who aren't used to being around somebody with Tourette's? Would you almost suggest to those people to go, well, oh, that was a cool tick, that I like that one, or as opposed to being standoffish? Do you know what I'm saying? You know the question I'm asking?
It's a bit like you make the joke when you're doing the stand-up, but there's probably people in the audience going, I shouldn't be laughing at this. And there's that awkward kind of, it is funny, but I shouldn't be laughing.
But you want people around you to treat you normally, for the want of a better word. But so what do they do? What do they say when this happens and they're around you?
Yeah, well, that's really up to the individual. So my personal approach is, I don't care. I never get offended. Ask as many questions, make as many jokes, as long as it's funnier than mine. You know, if you see me tick, who cares? Ask. I don't care, because I want it all be on the table. That way, everyone gets over it really quickly and it blends into normal. Yeah. But I do know some people who do not mention it, do not bring it up, do not highlight it, nothing, because they're still really insecure about it and they haven't yet learned how to deal with it. So in my honest answer to that is, just ignore until the person dictates how you can behave. So I know two people, they both have similar tics. One likes it when you laugh, the other one doesn't. One of them is pretty confident 18-year-old guy who, fine, go for it. The other one is a really insecure 16-year-old girl who is still kind of finding out who she is as a person, developing. Puberty's a horrible time. Yeah. So, you know, it's hard enough. And you've got Tourette's on top of it, and probably mixed with another comorbidity, which would be autism, ADHD, OCD, whatever it is. They don't like it. So it's up to that individual. For me, go for it. I love it.
We have a lot of participants that have got all sorts of different conditions, autism, intellectual disabilities, and we love it, don't we, Coach? Mm. When we interact with them, and we're involved in disability football and basketball, and we have so many laughs with them. It's not laughing at them, it's actually laughing with them and the joy that they bring to us. You know, and I think part of what we do is embracing everybody and actually seeing the person, not the condition. So, Seamus, now you're a keynote speaker. You kind of got out of the media, out of doing comedy because you weren't funny, and now you're just doing keynote speaking. Tell us a little bit about that.
You're not funny, boss.
This is what happened. And as you boys both know, being in radio, when you're in radio, it is the only thing that you live for. You're in the bubble, you have your blinders on, and you want Sydney breakfast. You want the capital city breakfast show. You want to be on Six Figures.
Been there, done that.
Here we go.
But that is your goal. That is your end. That's all you want.
Yep.
And you got to go to the small country towns to go to – anyway. I loved it. I love radio. I really – and I had my blinders on. I was in that bubble. All I wanted, bang, I wanted Gold Coast brekkie, right? And I started pitching while I was at Cairns doing brekkie radio. I started pitching to Triple M a night national show, a solo night show, right? Anyway, I get a message, an email from the Hit Network head. Hi, Seamus, confidential meeting tomorrow morning, 9:30 after the show. I was like, yes, this is it. I've got the Gold Coast. Come on. Next line read, feel free to bring a support person. And to be honest, blessing in disguise, because first of all, I was taken out of the bubble and my life in Cairns was amazing. It's a tourist town. Everything's open late at night. I was doing stand-up comedy during the week. I was partying on weekends. I was having 4 hours sleep a night. I was up at 4 o'clock doing breakfast. Like, it was an intense lifestyle and I was burning the candle at both ends. So when I got made redundant, I thought, oh, what a relief, if I'm honest, because it wasn't my choice. And I moved back home to mum and dad. I got on the dole and I did nothing, because I'd worked my ass off since 18 years of age, straight out of school for 13, 14 years, and I never got a break. So it was amazing. I stopped and I finally relaxed. I'd sleep in, I'd watch movies, I'd do stand-up, I'd do whatever I want, I'd party during the week because I could. And then it kind of hit me as I was out of the bubble. My mind opened up. Well, what else can I do? There's so many opportunities, so many things. And I realized, you know what? I've had such an amazing career. I've had a great life, something I didn't think I was capable of, given ADHD, Tourette syndrome, failing school. I wish I wish when I was 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, someone like me came into my school and said, hey, yes, it's okay to be different. It doesn't determine your future. It's okay. You're going to be fine. So I decided that's what I'm going to do. And I go all over Australia in schools, and I've just started going into businesses and doing it more for the corporate audience as well, and conferences. And my talk, my keynote talk, is called Turning a Flaw into a Superpower. And I share my journey and my story of overcoming those challenges to motivate my crowd to go, hey, you know what? The cards I've been dealt with, I can't control them, but I am in control of how I play the hand.
What's a moment that has made you laugh on a personal level? You know, like if you're a situation, you know, because of your condition, there must be times when you actually laugh and you think, well, that is actually quite funny and it's naturally funny. Can you give us any examples of that?
Absolutely. The first one is when I walk down the street and nod my head and they go, g'day, mate. And then I've actually almost been in fights because they're like, what are you looking at, bro? What are you looking at? You want to go? And I've actually learned if I keep going and keep ticking, I psych them out. So, you know, I'll be like, come on. And I'm like, what's wrong with this guy? And
so you put the ticks on sometimes.
You gotta amplify the tick, you know? And there, when masks were, everyone was wearing masks, I'd have the, or the, and because I'm wearing a mask, no one can see where it came from. And they're like, they're calling out, double shot latte. And everyone looks around and goes, what the hell? Who was that? And you start looking around as well. Where did that come from? So, I mean, they're inherently, it's funny. You can't help it. It is funny. And I typically, one of my instant go-tos, when I say I've got Tourette's, and I, to be honest, I don't like telling people because their response is, I am so sorry. Oh, I am so sorry. And I think, relax, it's not chlamydia. You can't catch it. Like, at ease. So, yeah, it just opens up a world of unlimited jokes around Tourette's.
We're running out of time, but, Doctor, do you want to ask an NDIS question? You got one?
No, I don't have an NDIS question. I was going to ask him, if people want to engage with you, how do they find you?
SeamusEvans.com on my website, or Mr. Seamus Evans on Facebook, Instagram, and it's SEAMUS. No, it's spelt Seamus.
Get in contact with Seamus, a.k.a. Seamus. Mate, fantastic chat. Really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'd love to catch up with you again sometime, if that's okay. We do another podcast called The J-Pod, which I might try and get you on for that as well, which is more of an in-depth and sensible sort of a podcast without the doctor. It's just me. Okay.
It's not very good. So. You know,
yeah, well, he doesn't reckon it's very good. Actually, I think it's better than this one. But anyway, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love it. I'd love to get on. And I really appreciate you guys having me on.
No, I'd loved having you on. And what was probably one of the best things about it was the coach didn't talk about his radio days.
I didn't. Other than,
or about Forbes and how he grew up and all the people that he'd met and telling silly stories. So I appreciate your time, Seamus, for not allowing him to do that.
I've got his phone number. I'll give him a call. We can have a chat off the air about that, and I'll give him a few tips because he's only a young fellow. He's young compared to what I am. In fact, everybody's young compared to me. Seamus Evans, good luck for the future, mate, and thanks so much for joining us on Coach and the Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. You were awesome.
Thanks, mate.
Hey, geez, a funny bloke. I mean, you're laughing not at them, but with people with Tourette's, and it can be funny when someone just pops out and says something.
What I loved about Seamus, the starting point for someone with Tourette's to want to get into being a TV host is just phenomenal, and he achieved that. And to me, it's one of the great stories that we've heard.
Yeah, I don't think that's the last you'll hear of Seamus Evans. I think this guy's got a career, and you'll be hearing a lot more of him.
Sorry, just quickly, the other story that I loved, and you relate to it, and I do, was his radio story about the national radio gig that he wanted, that he thought he had, and then he got sacked.
And he got sacked, yeah. Well, I know lots of guys that thought they had gigs, and they found out they were sacked in the old days in the paper. They'd read about it. I knew one bloke actually heard it on the news on his own radio station. And then the general manager said, oh, look, I'm sure
did,
I heard.
Did I mention that?
Did you miss the memo? In those days? Remember that? Memos, remember? Memorandums. But that's it for this show. But next show...
Another big show.
Another big show. Next show, we've got Susan Wood, who's the Community Engagement Lead at Spinal Cord Injuries Australia.
My journey with the NDIS has been challenging, let's put it that way. Even just getting on the NDIS was challenging. My disability is lifelong, so I was born with neonatal hypoxia paraplegia, which basically means stroke during my birth.
That's Susan Wood on Coach and the Doctor. All that is left to be said is...
press hard, three copies.
Have a great week, Coach out.
You've been listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. Dildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Dildacare, support coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Dildacare.